Meanwhile, Lord Feverstone's car had long since arrived at the Bellbury, a florid Edwardian mansion which had been built for a millionaire who admired Versailles. At the sides, it seemed to have sprouted into a widespread outgrowth of newer cement buildings, which housed the blood transfusion office. On his way up the wide staircase, Mark caught sight of himself and his companion in a mirror. Feverstone looked, as always, master of his clothes, his face, and of the whole situation. The blob of cotton wool on Mark's upper lip had been blown awry during the journey so that it looked like one half of a fiercely upturned false moustache and revealed a patch of blackened blood beneath it. A moment later, he found himself in a big windowed room with a blazing fire, being introduced to Mr. John Wither, Deputy Director of the NICE. Wither was a white-haired old man with a courtly manner. His face was clean-shaven and very large indeed, with watery blue eyes and something rather vague and chaotic about it. He did not appear to be giving them his whole attention, and this impression must, I think, have been due to the eyes, for his actual words and gestures were polite to the point of effusiveness. He said it was a very great pleasure to welcome Mr. Studdock among them. It added to the deep obligations under which Lord Feverstone had already laid him. He hoped that they had had an agreeable journey. Mr. Wither appeared to be under the impression that they had come by air, and when this was corrected, that they had come from London by train. Then he began inquiring whether Mr. Studdock found his quarters perfectly comfortable, and had to be reminded that they had only at that moment arrived. "I suppose," thought Mark, "the old chap is just trying to put me at ease." In fact, Mr. Wither's conversation was having precisely the opposite effect. Mark wished he would offer him a cigarette. His growing conviction that this man really knew nothing about him, and even that all the well-knit schemes and promises of Feverstone were at this moment dissolving into some sort of mist, was extremely uncomfortable. At last he took his courage in both hands and endeavoured to bring Mr. Wither to the point of saying that he was still not quite clear in what capacity he would be able to assist the Institute.
"I assure you, Mr. Studdock," said the Deputy Director with an unusually faraway look in his eye, "that you needn't anticipate the slightest difficulty on that point. There was never any idea of circumscribing your activities and your general influence on policy, much less your relations with your colleagues, and what I might call, in general, the terms of reference under which you would be collaborating with us, without the fullest possible consideration of your own views and, indeed, your own advice. You'll find us, Mr. Studdock, if I might express myself in that way, a very happy family."
"Oh, don't misunderstand me, sir," said Mark. "I didn't mean that at all. I only meant that I felt I should like some sort of idea of what exactly I should be doing if I came to you."
"Well now, when you speak of coming to us," said the Deputy Director, "that raises a point on which I hope there is no misunderstanding. I think we all agree that no question of residence need be raised. I mean at this stage. We all thought that you should be left entirely free to carry on your work wherever you pleased. If you care to live in London, Cambridge..."
"Edgestone," prompted Lord Feverstone.
"Ah, yes, Edgestone."
Here the Deputy Director turned around and addressed Feverstone.
"I was just explaining to Mr. Studdock, and I feel sure you will fully agree with me, that nothing was further from the mind of the committee than to dictate in any way, or even to advise, where your friend should live. Of course, wherever he lives, we should naturally place air transport and road transport at his disposal. I dare say, Lord Feverstone, you have already explained to him that he will find all questions of that sort will adjust themselves without the smallest difficulty."
"Really, sir," said Mark, "I wasn't thinking about that at all. I shouldn't have the smallest objection to living anywhere. I only..." The Deputy Director interrupted him. If anything so gentle as Wither's voice could be called an interruption.
"But I assure you, sir, that there is not the smallest objection to your residing wherever you may find it convenient. There was never at any stage the slightest suggestion..."
But here Mark, almost in desperation, ventured to interrupt himself. "It is the exact nature of the work," he said, "and of my qualifications for it that I wanted to get clear."
"My dear friend," said the Deputy Director, You need not have the slightest uneasiness in that direction. As I said before, you will find us a very happy family, and may feel perfectly satisfied that no questions as to your entire suitability have been agitating anyone's mind in the least. I should not be offering you a position among us if there was the slightest danger of your not being completely welcome at all, or at the least suspicion that your very valuable qualities were not fully appreciated. You are amongst friends here, Mr. Stoddock. I should be the last person to advise you to connect yourself with any organization where you ran the risk of being exposed to disagreeable personal contacts. Mark did not ask again in so many words what the NICE wanted him to do, partly because he began to be afraid that he was supposed to know this already, and partly because a perfectly direct question would have sounded a crudity in that room, a crudity which might suddenly exclude him from the warm and almost drugged atmosphere of vague yet heavily important confidence in which he was gradually being enfolded. "You are very kind," he said. "The only thing I should like to get just a little clearer is the exact scope of the appointment."
"Well," said Mr. Wither, in a voice so low and rich that it was almost a sigh, "I'm very glad you've raised this issue now in a quite informal way. Obviously, neither you nor I wish to commit ourselves in this room in any sense which was at all injurious to the powers of the committee. I quite understand your motives and respect them. We are not, of course, speaking of an appointment in that quasi-technical sense of the term. It would be improper for both of us, though you may well remind me in different ways, to do so. Or at least it might lead to certain inconveniences. But I think I can most definitely assure you that nobody wants to force you into any kind of straight waistcoat or bed of procrustes. We do not really think amongst ourselves in terms of strictly demarcated functions, of course. I take it that men like you and men like me are, well, to put it frankly, hardly in the habit of using concepts of that type. Everyone in the Institute feels that his own work is not so much a departmental contribution to an end already defined as a movement or grade in the progressive self-definition of an organic whole." And Mark said, God forgive him, for he was young and shy and vain and timid all in one, "I do think that is so important. The elasticity of your organization is one of the things that attracts me." After that, he had no further chance of bringing the director to the point, and whenever the slow, gentle voice ceased, he found himself answering it in his own style, and apparently helpless to do otherwise, despite the torturing recurrence of the question, "What are we both talking about?" At the very end of the interview, there came one moment of clarity. Mr. Wither supposed that he, Mark, would find it convenient to join the NICE club. Even for the next few days, he would be freer as a member than someone's guest. Mark agreed and then flushed crimson like a small boy on learning that the easiest course was to become a life member at the cost of £200. He had not that amount in the bank. Of course, if he had got the job with its £1,500 a year, all would be well. But had he got it, was there a job at all? "How silly," he said aloud. "I haven't got my checkbook with me." A moment later, he found himself on the stairs with Feverstone. "Well," said Mark eagerly. Feverstone did not seem to hear him. "Well," repeated Mark, "when shall I know my fate? I mean, have I got the job?" "Hello, Guy!" bawled Feverstone suddenly to a man in the hall beneath. Next moment he had trotted down the foot of the stairs, grasped his friend warmly by the hand, and disappeared. Mark, following him more slowly, found himself in the hall, silent, alone, and self-conscious, among the groups and pairs of chattering men who were all crossing it towards the big folding doors on his left. It seemed to last long, this standing, this wondering what to do, this effort to look natural and not to catch the eyes of strangers. The noise and the agreeable smells which came from the folding doors made it obvious that people were going to lunch. Mark hesitated, uncertain of his own status. In the end, he decided that he couldn't stand there looking like a fool any longer, and went in. He had hoped that there would be several small tables at one of which he could have sat alone, but there was only a single long table, already so nearly filled, that after looking in vain for Feverstone, he had to sit down beside a stranger. "I suppose one sit where one likes," he murmured as he did so, but the stranger apparently did not hear.
He was a bustling sort of man who was eating very quickly and talking at the same time to his neighbor on the other side. "That's just it," he was saying. "As I told him, it makes no difference to me which way they settle it. I've got no objection to the IJP people taking over the whole thing if that's what the DD wants, but I dislike it being one man responsible for it when half the work's been done by someone else. As I said to him, you've got now three HDs all tumbling over one another about the same job that really could be done by a clerk. It's becoming ridiculous. Look what happened this morning." Conversation on these lines continued throughout the meal. Although the food and drink were excellent, it was a relief to Mark when people began getting up from the table. Following the general movement, he recrossed the hall and came into a large room furnished as a lounge where coffee was being served. Here at last he saw Feverstone. Indeed, it would have been difficult not to notice him, for he was the center of a group and laughing prodigiously. Mark wished to approach him, if only to find out whether they were expecting him to stay the night, and if so, whether a room had been assigned to him. But the knot of men around Feverstone was of that confidential kind which is difficult to join. He moved towards one of the many tables and began turning over the glossy pages of an illustrated weekly. Every few seconds he looked up to see if there was any chance of getting a word with Feverstone alone. The fifth time he did so, he found himself looking into the face of one of his own colleagues, a fellow of Bracton called William Hingist. The progressive element called him, though not to his face, Bill the Blizzard. Hingist had not, as Curry anticipated, been present at the college meeting, and was hardly on speaking terms with Lord Feverstone. Mark realized with a certain awe that he was a man directly in touch with NICE, one who started, so to speak, at a point beyond Feverstone. Hingist, who was a physical chemist, was one of the two scientists at Bracton who had a reputation outside England. I hope the reader has not been misled into supposing that the fellows of Bracton were a highly distinguished body. It was certainly not the intention of the progressive element to elect mediocrities to fellowships, but their determination to elect sound men crudely limited their field of choice. And as Busby had once said, "You can't have everything." Bill the Blizzard had an old-fashioned curly moustache, in which white had almost, but not completely, triumphed over yellow, a large beak-like nose, and a bald head. "This is an unexpected pleasure," said Mark, with a hint of formality. He was always a little afraid of Hingist.
"Huh?"
grunted Bill.
"Hey! Oh, it's you, Starlock. Didn't know they secured your services here."
"I was sorry not to see you at the college meeting yesterday," said Mark. This was a lie. The progressive element always found Hingist's presence an embarrassment. As a scientist, and the only really eminent scientist they had, he was their rightful property. But he was that hateful anomaly, the wrong sort of scientist. Glossop, who was a classic, was his chief friend in college. He had the air, the affectation, Curry called it, of not attaching much importance to his own revolutionary discoveries in chemistry, and of valuing himself much more on being a Hingist. The family was of almost mythical antiquity, never contaminated, as its 19th century historian had said, by traitor, placeman, or baronetcy. He had been given the particular offence on occasion of de Broglie's visit to Edgestone. The Frenchman had spent his spare time exclusively in Bill the Blizzard's society, and when an enthusiastic junior fellow had thrown out a feeler about a rich feast of science which the two savants must have shared, Bill the Blizzard had appeared to search his memory for a moment and then replied that he didn't think they had got onto that subject. "Gassing almanac to got a nonsense, I suppose," was Curry's comment, though not in Hingist's presence.
"Hey, what's that? College meeting?"
said Blizzard.
"What were they talking about?"
"About the sale of Bragdon Wood."
"All nonsense,"
muttered the Blizzard. "I hope you would have agreed with the decision we came to."
"It makes no difference what decision they came to."
"Oh," said Mark with some surprise.
"It was all nonsense. The NICE would have had the wood in any case. They had the powers to compel a sale."
"What an extraordinary thing. I was given to understand they were going to Cambridge if we didn't sell." Hingist sniffed loudly.
"Not a word of truth in it. As to its being an extraordinary thing, that depends on what you mean. There's nothing extraordinary in the fellows of Bracton talking all afternoon about an unreal issue. And there's nothing extraordinary in the fact that the NICE could wish, if possible, to hand over to Bracton the odium of turning the heart of England into a cross between an abortive American hotel and a glorified gasworks. The only real puzzle is why the NICE would want that bit of land."
I suppose we shall find out as things go on.
You may. I shan't.
Oh? Said Mark, interrogatively.
I've had enough of it, said Hengist,
lowering his voice.
I'm leaving tonight. I don't know what you were doing at Bracton, but if it was any good, I'd advise you to go back and stick to it.
Really? Said Mark. Why do you say that?
It doesn't matter for an old fellow like me, said Hengist, but they could play the devil with you. Of course, it all depends on what a man likes.
As a matter of fact, said Mark, I haven't fully made up my mind. He had been taught to regard Hengist as a warped reactionary. I don't even know what my job will be if I stayed.
What's your subject?
Sociology.
Ha, said Hengist. In that case, I can soon point out the man you'd be under. A fellow called Steele. Over there by the window, do you see?
Perhaps you could introduce me.
You're determined to stay then?
Well, I suppose I ought to at least see him.
All right, said Hengist. No business of mine.
Then he added in a louder voice, Steele. Steele turned around. He was a tall, unsmiling man with that kind of face which, though long and horse-like, has nevertheless rather thick and pouting lips.
This is Stardock, said Hengist, the new man for your department.
Then he turned away. Oh, said Steele. Then, after a pause, did you say my department? That's what he said, replied Mark, in an attempt to smile. But perhaps he got it wrong. I'm supposed to be a sociologist, if that throws any light on it. I'm HD for sociology, all right, said Steele, but this is the first I've heard about you. Who told you you were meant to be here? Well, as a matter of fact, said Mark, the whole thing is rather vague. I've just had a talk with the deputy director, but we didn't actually go into any details.
How did you manage to see him?
Lord Feverstone introduced me. Steele whistled.
I say, Cossa, he called out to a freckle-faced man who was passing by. Listen to this. Feverstone has just unloaded this chap on our department, taking him straight to the DD without saying a word to me about it. What do you think of that?
Well, I'm damned, said Cossa,
hardly glancing at Mark, but looking very hard at Steele. I'm sorry, said Mark, a little more loudly and a little more stiffly than he had yet spoken. Don't be alarmed, I seem to be put in a rather false position. There must be some misunderstanding. As a matter of fact, I am at the moment merely having a look around. I'm not at all certain I intend to stay in any case. Neither of the other two took any notice of this last suggestion.
That's Feverstone all over, said Crosser to Steele.
Steele turned to Mark.
I shouldn't advise you to take much notice of what Lord Feverstone says here, he remarked. This isn't his business at all.
All I object to, said Mark, wishing that he could prevent his face from turning red, is being put in a false position. I only came over as an experiment. It's a matter of indifference to me whether I take a job at the NICE or not.
You see, said Steele to Cossa, there isn't really any room for a man in our show, especially for someone who doesn't know the work. Unless they put him on the UL.
That's right, said Cossa.
Mr. Stardock, I think, said a new voice at Mark's elbow,
a treble voice which seemed disproportionate to the huge hill of a man whom he saw when he turned his head. He recognized the speaker at once. His dark, smooth face and black hair were unmistakable, and so was the foreign accent. This was Professor Philostrato, the great physiologist who Margaret sat next to at dinner about 2 years before. He was fat to that degree which is comic on the stage, but the effect was not funny in real life. Mark was charmed that such a man could have remembered him.
I'm very glad you have come to join us, said Philostrato, taking hold of Mark's arm and gently piloting him away from Steele and Cossa.
To tell you the truth, said Mark, I'm not sure I have. I was brought over by Feverstone, but he's disappeared. And Steele, I haven't been in the department, I suppose, doesn't seem to know anything about me.
Bah, Steele, said the professor. That is all a bagatelle. He get too big for his boots. He will be put in his place one of these days. And maybe you will put him. I have read all your work, CC. Do not consider him.
I have a strong objection to being put in a false position, began Mark.
Listen, my friend, interrupted Philostrato. You must put all such ideas out of your head. The first thing to realize is that the NICE is serious. is nothing less than the existence of the human race that all depends on our work, our real work, you comprehend? You will find frictions and impertinences amongst this canaglia, this rabble. But they are no more to be regarded than your dislike of a brother officer when the battle is at its crisis.
As long as I'm given something to do that is worth doing, said Mark, I shouldn't allow anything of the sort to interfere with it.
Yes, yes, that is right. The work is more important than you can yet understand. You see, these steels, these fever stones, they are of no consequence. As long as you have the goodwill of the deputy director, you snap your fingers at them. You need listen to no one but him, you comprehend? Ah, and there is one other. Do you not have the fairy for your enemy? For the rest, you laugh at them.
The fairy?
Yes, they call her the fairy. Oh my God, a terrible incassatia. She's head of our police, the institutional police. Echo, she come. I'll present you. Miss Hardcastle, permit that I present you Mr. Stadock.
Mark found himself writhing from the stoker's or carter's hand grip of a big woman in a black short-skirted uniform. Despite a bust that would have done credit to a Victorian barmaid, she was rather thickly built than fat, and her iron grey hair was cropped short. Her face was square, stern and pale, and her voice deep. A smudge of lipstick, laid on with violent inattention to the real shape of her mouth, was her only concession to fashion, and she rolled or chewed on a long black cheroot, unlit between her teeth. As she talked, she had the habit of removing this, staring intently at the mixture of lipstick and saliva on its mangled end, and then replacing it more firmly than before. She sat down immediately in a chair close to where Mark was standing, flung her right leg over one of the arms, and fixed him with a gaze of cold intimacy.